I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
All right, we're back for another episode of the Fried Egg Podcast, and we are happy to welcome our esteemed guest this week, Josh Gregory. Josh won back-to-back national championships as the head coach at Augusta State, and was also more recently the head coach at SMU before now venturing into the professional golf world, where he serves as a coach for players such as John Peterson, Kelly Kraft, Henrik Norlander, and some other web guys like Carlos Ortiz. Josh, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely. I think it'd be great if you gave us a little bit of your background, your story, how you got into golf, and your playing career, and then how you got into coaching.
I started at a young age. I think I've got pictures of me when I was 18 months old with my dad playing, and I was an only child, so I was spoiled rotten with love, and grew up playing every sport, kind of known to man, and kind of stuck with golf and baseball, and played just right around the cart with my dad, and play all the time, and we had a great course that I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, a place called Windyke Country Club, and they had 36 holes, and we had an 18-hole par 3 course, so I could pretty much be dropped off and spend all day out there, and that's how I spend every day of my summer. And, it was the best place in the world as a kid to grow up and play golf. And went on to play college golf at SMU in Dallas and played under Hank Haney. He was our college coach and learned a ton from him about how to play the game. Learned a ton about work ethic. He's probably one of the hardest working guys I've ever seen in my entire life. And I learned a ton about the game, learned a ton about discipline, course management, swing, et cetera, from him. Tried to play a little bit professionally after that for about 2 years, and quickly realized that I wasn't good enough. I didn't really know that the Hooters Tour played on the weekend. I pretty much finished most of my events on Friday, so I had a lot of weekends off, which is not so good in the professional golf world, but physically I was plenty good enough. I just didn't have the mindset. I didn't have the belief. I didn't have the selfishness, quite honestly, to be great. Went about it the wrong way. I worked really hard, spent a lot of hours trying to perfect technique and perfect the golf swing and just doing things that weren't very productive or conducive to good play. So I learned a lot about, coaching from all my mistakes. So, I knew that I quit playing after 2 years that coaching was the only thing I ever had in the back of my mind that I wanted to do, and I thought I could be pretty good at it. Little did I know how hard it was to be a college golf coach. I had no idea the work that went on behind the scenes, the recruiting, the fundraising, paperwork, all that stuff. I just assumed you showed up at practice at 1 o'clock and tried to help your guys get better and go from there. But fortunately, I got a great break. I was hired by Coach Richard Sykes at NC State, is a Hall of Famer who's retiring this year. The job was open, and I interviewed and was lucky enough to get it. And I was the assistant men's and women's golf coach at North Carolina State, working for both programs. That kind of started my career, and I was so indebted to them to give me a chance, because had they not taken a chance on a 24-year-old who really didn't know what college golf, what coaching was all about, I would have never had the college coaching career I had, and let alone being able to do what I'm doing now. But Coach Sykes taught me everything about how to treat people. He was the best at it. I mean, he said the best thing in the world is being called a coach. The best thing in the world is, 15, 20 years down the road, one of your former players will pick up the phone and say, "Hey, coach, how you're doing?" I learned a lot from that mentality. You love your players first. You take care of them first. I'm not afraid to say, "Hey, I tried to become their friend first before I became their coach." And whether that's right or wrong, that's how my personality works. And I think that's the way the best coaches are. You have to get their respect as their friend and as their buddy before they can ever trust you with how to really make their golf game better. And I learned that from him, and it's kind of been my philosophy throughout my coaching career: is love your guys first, coach them second, and that everything else kind of falls into place. So that was kind of after my couple years at NC State. I went to was fortunate enough to get hired at a state. And I got to Georgia and coached there for 9 years. Had some really great players. Really, really cool place to coach. One of the probably few universities in the world that actually gets college golf, and college golf actually means something. We were the only Division I sport at that school. It was a Division II school competing in Division I men's and women's golf. And we were fortunate enough to win back-to-back national championships in 2010 and 2011. Went on from there to back to my alma mater at SMU and coached for 3 years and kind of rebuilt the program there and got it going. And then now I'm out on my own and trying to see if I can make a bigger difference in the game of golf coaching on a full-time, full basis, whether it's the best players in the world like Patrick Reed or John Peterson or Kelly Kraft, or whether it's a 10-year-old kid just trying to get better. It's still the same principles apply, and I'm very thankful to get to do what I do every day. I've never really had a real job. I've gotten to coach every day. I've gotten to go to the golf course every day, and now I get to do that all day long, and I'm very, very thankful for it, and trying to do it a little different way, and just trying to coach and coach the way I would want to be coached. So far it's going great, and I'm really lucky to work with a bunch of cool guys that buy in, and so far they're getting a lot better.
Yeah, that's I think, from what I heard on when I heard you talk earlier and what interested me in bringing you on, I'd love to hear more about your approach and how it's a little bit different from, the traditional strict instruction approach and more of a coaching approach.
Yeah, I have the utmost respect for pure instructors, and I've been fortunate enough to be around Butch Harmon. I've seen David Ledbetter teach. I've seen Hank Haney, obviously been around him a lot. Tom Stickney, who's a top 100 instructor, very close friend of mine. Brian White, guys like that, who I think the world of as great, great instructors, and Randy Smith, people like that, that I've been around and learned so much from them. But I wouldn't label myself, as an instructor. I mean, obviously there is a teaching instruction component to any form of coaching, and there is, some teaching instruction to what I do. But that's not my first love. That's not my first passion. My coaching and figuring out how to make guys better. And, that comes with understanding personality first. And that's where my job begins. The coaching is through a relationship. You have to have a relationship with each player you coach, and you have to understand what drives them. Some kids need to kick the butt. Some kids need a pat on the back. And you've got to figure out that first. You've got to figure out what motivates them, what drives them. And that's how I always coached in college. I didn't believe in college golf as a team sport. I think coaches who believe in it as a team sport are missing the boat, because it's not. It's an individual sport. It just happens to be wrapped in a team format. And I coached individuals. I figured if I got the best out of each individual, each of my 8 or 9 kids on the team, then the team would take care of itself at the end of the day. Yes, you have to be a team off the course, and yes, the team chemistry is terribly important, but it really means nothing when you're in the golf course. You got to take care of yourself. You got to be selfish. You got to be an individual and do what's best for you. And that's kind of how I evolved my coaching theory of coaching each individual to the best of my ability. And that means there's different plans. There's different rules for different kids as well. So carrying that over into my kind of new job as being a golf coach. A full-time golf coach, not a college golf coach. I wasn't sure, quite honestly. I knew there was a need for coaching at the junior level. I knew there was a need for pure coaching at the collegiate level. I knew there was, but I wasn't so certain on the professional level. I thought it could work. I really did. But I wasn't certain, and I was fortunate enough to get a call from Patrick Reed about a year and a half ago or so. And I coached him in college, and he called me and wanted me to help him out and work with him. And he had some great success last year. He went from 23rd in the world to 7th. I think 20 out of 32 events worldwide, he finished in the top 10. So it really validated that there was a need for coaching. And we didn't, there were probably 95% of what I did with him and what I do with my guys today is practice plans, how to structure your practice, spending equal time in all four phases of the game, full swing, distance wedges, chipping, pitching bunker, and then putting. And then in addition to that, not spending all of your time in technique. You're doing a lot of competitive practice, a lot of one ball work. Just essentially making practice fun, making it mean something. You hear guys say all the time how hard they work. Well, coach, I'm working hard, but I'm not getting any better. Well, clearly you're not working at it in the best way. You're not working at it in an effective way. So it's my job as a coach to figure out what is the most effective way for that player. And every player has different plans. Every player has different ways we go about it. But I try to make it as simple as possible. You look at a player's strengths and weaknesses. Whether I met with John Peters and with Kelly Kraft when we first started working, I mean, you look at the strengths and weaknesses, and you go from there, and you analyze it. And it amazed me that some of these guys on the PGA Tour really didn't know where they ranked in comparison to their peers in some of the stats. And that's my job. My job is, as I tell them, your job is to swing the club. My job is to provide the plan, provide the path, provide the knowledge for you to get better. And your job is to show up and swing the club. And that's what I love doing. I love the structure of it. I love coaching and teaching the short game. That's probably what would be my strength as a teacher, is from 120 yards and in, really getting guys to practice it in an effective way. But, I have different roles for every guy. Some guys, I'm their swing coach as well. I understand the golf swing. I understand it. But my job is not to understand everything about the golf swing. That's not my love and my passion. My job is to understand the players that I coach, understand their golf swing, and understand how to get the best out of their golf swing, and understand, I have kind of a simple theory. It's, we all get so wrapped up in technique and learning, trying to fix your shots by technique. And I kind of have a little different approach. I try to get guys to hit shots to fix technique. If you're overhooking the golf ball or hitting high draws or whatever, what the opposite of that would be a low fade. So always trying to find the happy medium and learning to fix techniques by hitting shots. And I think it's a very simplistic way of looking at it. So far it's working pretty good for the guys. But again, it starts with a relationship. It starts with that trust factor and being all in and knowing that you love your guys and they know you love them. You're doing everything you can possible to help them get better.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's you coach individuals, but your job is to work as a team with your guys. So I'm kind of curious how, with different players, you adapt, and more specifically, different personalities, you adapt your plans and how you structure practice.
Well, if you look at the two guys I'm working with most exclusively right now, Kelly Kraft and John Peterson, I mean, they're polar opposite personalities. I mean, John Peterson is very high strung. He can be a little hot under the collar on the golf course. His attitude can sometimes get in the way. So I know with him that I have to be pretty hard on him. There's times when I've caddied for him a couple times, and when we're working together, he told me from day one, you need to be hard on me, otherwise this isn't going to work. And that's not necessarily my strength. I don't enjoy being the back guy. I don't like that. That's definitely my weakness. But I know with him that if I'm not that way with him, I'm not going to get the most out of him. And you have to be hard on him. You have to, get in his face when his attitude's acting poorly. But you also have to build him up when he's doing the right things. Kelly, for example, is a much more laid back personality, extremely talented, extremely aggressive in how he goes about playing the game, and I've had to, but he didn't have a real good plan, a really good understanding of what he really needed to do to work on. He's always had a great golf swing. He does some great work with his swing coach, Troy Denton, and that's what's great about what I do. I can, I have no ego in this deal. If that means involving a swing coach, another coach, that is, I'm here to make the player better. And I'm lucky with Kelly that I have a great relationship with Troy Denton, and that he's quite honestly one of the few coaches that is humble enough to understand that, hey, we're all in this to help Kelly get better. And if that means he's doing his part and I'm doing my part, and Kelly gets better, then it's a win-win situation. There's not a lot of coaches that would kind of check their ego at the door and allow that to happen, and they want to have, everybody kind of wants to have control of everything. it's not my deal. I'm all in it to help the player get better, whether that's me doing it exclusively or whether that's involving somebody else in the team effort as well. But, you know, more specifically with Kelly, I mean, he needed structure. He needed a lot of short game help. He was, you know, his stats were he was outside the top 150 in almost every short game category, and he's slowly improving to that, and you can see the results are starting to click with finishing, you know, 21st, 28th, 27th, and 2nd in his last 4 out of 5 events. So, you know, he needed structure. He needed to be told how good he was. Both he and John are very similar personalities in that they are not afraid. They both have the belief that they can be one of the best in the world, but candidly, they just didn't have the full game to match up with that belief. And now, hopefully, I'm helping them develop a full game to where there is no weakness in their game that can match up with that belief. So when they're in those Sunday late afternoon periods, they're not going to be afraid. And I think that's shown. You know, John's had a 15th and a 12th this year and was in the last group at Phoenix, which was a big step for him. And Kelly finishing second last week was a big step for him as well to kind of validate the work that we've been doing. But more importantly, you know, get that confidence that you need to feel like, hey, I belong with the best in the world.
So with your guys, they're mostly, you know, under 30. You've got a stable of web guys, and you've got Norlander, Kraft, Reed, who's obviously a world-class wedge player, Peterson. Would you say that inside 120 yards is where the biggest kind of difference between the college and pro game is? Or how would you compare the two?
I think there's two things that are the difference. I think clearly, I'd say probably three things to be safe. They're misses off the tee. Guys on tour, you know, very rarely hit it in the junk. They very rarely have penalty shots. Guys in college golf, you know, their miss is a little bit greater. Players on tour miss it in much better spots. There's no doubt their wedge the wedge play from 120 yards and in is so much better at the PGA Tour level than the collegiate level. And then I think the final difference, if you look at that, the best putters in the world are really good from 6 to 12 feet. Almost whether it's Brent Sedeker, whether it's Patrick Reed, whether it's Jordan Spieth, whether it was Jason Day last year, who had maybe the best putting year of all time, they're really good from 6 and 12 feet. They don't three putt and they make their 6 to 12 footers. That is the biggest difference. That, you know, everybody on tour pretty much makes it, you know, from 3, 4, and 5 feet, and from 15 to 20 feet, you know, their make percentages are pretty similar. But from 6 to 12 feet is where you really see the Brad Snedekers, the Jordan Spieths, those guys of the world, Patrick Reed of the world, really separate themselves from the rest. So, you know, a lot of the practices and the games I do, you know, are based on PGA Tour stats and based on the player strengths and weaknesses, and we combine those and develop a lot of games and competitions to try to simulate what they're going to do out on tour. And I think that's where the guys really enjoy themselves. I mean, let's face it, you don't practice to practice. You practice to be able to compete. And I'm trying to make practice very competitive, to make it very intense. You know, if we're going to be out there for 3 hours, let's really get after it. Let's make it intense. Let's make it, you know, when you leave, I want you to be mentally tired. I don't want you to be physically tired. I want you to be mentally exhausted and say, hey, we got something out of today. You know, here were our goals. Here was what we accomplished. Here were the stats in our games. Here was our wedge proximities to the holes. Here's how many putts we made from 6 to 12 feet. You know, all those things. Let's keep track of it. Keep a journal of it. Do things that are really, you know, tracking your progress, so we're not just out there putting in the hours, because everybody works hard. Everybody on the PGA Tour works hard. There's nobody that's out there just because of talent alone. But instead of working hard, let's work effectively. And that's how my kind of word I use a lot. My guys probably get tired of hearing me say that, but let's work effectively. I don't care how hard you work, but let's work effectively.
What are some of your kind of favorite drills that you guys do, and you know, do you usually have a group of guys out there practicing for these sessions, or you know, what do you do if you're working alone with a guy?
You know, it's all related to what's going on in their game. I mean, there's still you know, several things that are kind of across the board that we do. I mean, you know, we do a lot. You know, for example, on putting, we're doing a lot of putting drills, a lot of speed drills with, you know, with five balls and putting from maybe starting to 10 feet, 20 feet, 30 feet, 40 feet, 50 feet, and always doing something different, randomizing the practice, making sure that, the only time you should ever be hitting the same putt twice, candidly, is if you're doing any form of technical work. Other than that, every putt, chip, wedge, full swing, whatever it may be, every shot should be different because that's what you're going to get on the golf course. Do a lot of speed work with five balls from different distances. Do a lot of, one of my favorite games that we do is you simply do 50 putts. You do 50 putts from 3 to 12 feet. You do 5 putts from each station, 5 spots around the hole, and see how many you make. I mean, PGA Tour average says you should make 32 out of 50 from those 50 putts. And just trying to do that to where it's simulating pressure. I mean, you start missing a few, you get a little nervous, you get a little frustrated, you got to fight through it. You got to try to kind of stick it out. So it's what I'm trying to do with these guys and what I'm trying to coach them to do to get them to do it when they're on their own. The best players in the world do the same things every day. And the best, whether it's in business, whether it's in golf, you write things down, you hold yourself accountable, you do the same things over and over. I mean, I can't, you always hear the stories about how many golf balls Vijay Singh hit. During his prime, he was one of the best ball strikers on tour. Well, he did the same drills day in and day out. He had a alignment rod behind him. He had a glove under his left arm. He had a water bottle just to the right of the golf ball, so he made sure the club was exited on the proper plane. Well, that's why he became a great ball striker. It wasn't because he was always searching for new things. He did the same things over and over. And that's what, I'm trying to do with these guys in their practice habits and in their whether it's the way they're swinging the club, whether what we're doing in our chipping, pitching, wedging, putting technique, whatever it may be, we're doing the same things over and over and over again with small variations to still keep it fun and still keep it fresh. But the best do the same things day in, day out.
Yeah, I mean, it's like anything.
Opposite of what I did. I was constantly searching for going around in circles, and I think without the right guidance, I think that's where the coaching element is really is seeing some success and seeing that it's needed out there. And sometimes, honestly, as a coach or as an instructor, you have to learn to shut up as well. You have to learn to be quiet and just let your guy go. Because I think too many times as coaches or instructors, we're torn and always wanting to feel like we're saying something or changing something. And you've got to have enough confidence in what you're doing and what the process of what you're doing. But sometimes you just got to be quiet. That if things are good, hey, let's just go with it. Let's let it roll. So like I told Kelly Kraft earlier today, clearly what he's doing is working. So this isn't the time to make changes and search for ways to win. This is the time to just keep doing exactly what we're doing, monitoring what's going on, and you know what? We're going to put himself in that position enough times that hopefully those wins will happen. It's not the time to search for how to get better, because clearly it's working. Worked with John Peterson earlier today. We had a great 3-hour short game session, and we literally did the same drills, same games that we do almost every time when we practice, and even do the same things on the road. And I think that's where also trying to get players to understand that you practice at home, you prepare on the road, and there's a big difference. There's a big difference about it, and that's where I think too many guys spend too much time practicing on the road and searching for things, as opposed to that's the time to prepare for the golf course, learn the golf course, stick to the drills, stick to the games that work for you, and go from there.
That's interesting. I write a lot about golf courses and architecture, and I'm kind of curious how you guys go about, kind of breaking down a golf course and developing a strategy for specific holes.
Yeah, good question. Again, it depends on the player. John Peterson is a phenomenal driver of the ball. He's one of the better drivers of the ball on tour. So he's going to driver almost at every hole because that's his strength. Something that I've worked with Kelly on pretty hard is understanding he's a very aggressive player, but he sometimes is too aggressive with the wrong clubs. Learning that, from 120 yards and in or 130 yards and in, we've got to get so good with all four of his wedges that there's not a flag that he can't go at. That if you want to shoot low scores, we've got to hit those close. And understanding what, getting so good from all those yardages with all four of his wedges that he's choosing the club based on what that shot calls for, not what club he feels most comfortable hitting. And there's a big difference in that. And so that's where the strategy comes in. And also understanding that with a 6-iron, from 200 yards, average proximity to hole is about 30 to 34 feet on the PGA Tour, that hitting a 6-iron to 30 feet is okay. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to hit it to the fat side of the green. It's okay just to make a nice, easy par from there. And that's something that he was kind of super aggressive in his game, going at too many flags with 6-irons, and quite honestly not being aggressive enough with his wedges, or not having enough shots with his wedges to truly get his proximity to the hole closer so he could have more chances at birdies. Also, now he's, both of those guys are developing more and more short game, better and better short game skills, so they can go at more flags. Patrick Reed, as good as his short game is, he can go at every flag he wants to, because his short game is so sound and so solid that there's not a flag he's not afraid of. But until you get to that point to where your short game is sound enough, you've got to play a little bit more conservative. You've got to play to your strengths and not put yourself in positions that you don't have the shots to recover from. So, again, cater to each guy's game, cater to each guy's ability.
Yeah, I think at that level,
overall goal is getting to where there is not a weakness in those four physical areas of the game: full swing, wedging, chipping, pitching, bunker, and putting. That there really isn't a weakness. That they're sound in all areas, so they're not really having to play away from any of those areas. But if one area is struggling, the others can take care of the rest.
Yeah, I imagine inside 120 yards for these guys, you can't have a bad number, and you can't have a shot you can't hit.
Yeah, and you always hear, well, that was a bad number, it was a tweener number, it was whatever it may be, and there are certain numbers that guys don't like, but that's why you work on your wedges from all those different yardages with all three or four of your wedges. So, you know, like last week at Pebble, the greens were so soft, their slope from front to back, and a lot of back flags. If you didn't have the ability to flight the golf ball and just kind of have it, floating a little bit, you were going to be ripping it back off the front of the green. So learning to choose the club based on what the shot requires, as opposed to just choosing the club on which one you feel most comfortable with. And that's kind of the essential goal there and then learning around the greens, learning to chip and pitch with different clubs as well. I mean, there was a couple cool stories, a couple cool chances this weekend when Kelly had long bunker shots. We've been working on learning to hit 52s and 56s out of different lies, different types of bunkers, different types of sand, and he was able to execute those shots this weekend when before he would have probably just chosen a 60-degree wedge and hit it to maybe 15, 20 feet and not been able to get up and down. And, John Peterson the previous week in Phoenix when I was caddying for him, he had a pitch shot on the 17th hole, and kind of a dicey pitch shot, and he tipped it up there at about 8 inches, and all he said was, "Coach, all I can think about is how many times I've hit this in practice this week." And that's what you coach for. Those moments are pretty cool.
Yeah, that had to be awesome. With going on the bag as a coach, how do you have to kind of change your approach as the caddy and, being the looper? And, as you said earlier, I imagine a lot of times it's about kind of shutting up and carrying the bag.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I have the utmost respect for caddies after doing them. Gosh, I always do, but I'd be more so down. It's hard work. It's hard work to just stay up. Those guys walk fast, and especially when you're raking bunkers and going to them, whatever. It's tough. But, you do have to flip your role a little bit. You have to kind of – but still, I think the best caddies in the world would be awesome coaches. I really do. And the same thing the other way. The best coaches in the world would also be awesome caddies, because it's a very similar job if you're good at it. It's very similar. And so you have to know when to say something. You have to know when to let your player vent. You have to also know when to tell them, hey, it's time to go play golf. Shut up and let's go. I think that's a key part of being a good caddy, a good coach. And I think you also have to know when to give, when too much, when to give information and when not to give information. When a player's got a green light flag and from 145 yards, it's a perfect wedge. There's not a whole lot that needs to be said.
Yeah.
But when it's 200 yards to a tucked flag with water on the right and a ridge to the left or whatever it may be, that's when, hey, you got to be confident enough in your delivery to say, hey, bro, this is a 6-iron, 25 feet left, right there, and we're gonna 2-pot and move on. So I think it's a hard deal. I'm learning to be a better caddy when needed, but it's fun. I think as a coach, you learn so much more being inside the ropes and being there and understand what your players think and what they're going through, and you're able to coach them way more effectively after you have that experience. And that's why as a coach, when I'm on the road, I spend a lot of time there watching the play. I'll never go to a tournament and leave on a Wednesday and just, you know, unless I just have to. But I'm a big believer in watching guys play, whether it's all weekend or whether it's maybe just Thursday and Friday, because that's what I learned the most. You're gonna get what you see on the range, what you see in practice rounds. A lot of times, is a lot different than what you see in the competition. At the end of the day, my job is to help them shoot the best score they possibly can. So if I'm not watching them in competition and not helping them learn how to manage the courts better, evaluate what they're doing right and wrong, then honestly, I'm not doing my job. And that's what I'm hired to do, is to help them shoot the lowest score possible. So I think it's extremely important as coaches, instructors, whatever it may be, to stick around and watch your guys compete.
So you got to let us in. Did you make any, you know, hack caddy moves? Like, you know, did you get any bad looks?
Oh, yeah. Fortunately, the caddies I've been with so far have all been cool. And I've explained to them on the first tee, look, I don't do this full time. I love doing it. I'm going to do my best, and I'll try not to screw up. But I'm probably going to stand in the wrong place. I'm probably going to forget to rake their bunker when it's my turn to rake their bunker or whatever it may be. But yeah, I dropped the bag once. Fortunately, it wasn't in somebody's backswing. I've definitely dropped towels and head covers. That's normal for me. Usually have a set over under of how many I'm going to drop in a day. The confusing part is sometimes when you're supposed to rake the other player's bunker or not. Obviously, I understand I got to rake mine, but when you got to rake somebody else's bunker, I've messed that one up a couple times as well. But fortunately, no major mistakes that have cost anybody any shots or any dirty looks just yet. I just try to do the best I can. But the caddies out there are cool. They're fun to hang out with, and they're fun. You learn a lot. You learn a lot about. They're good about. Showing the rookies what the heck to do.
Yeah, they're like a brethren out there. I'm curious with it being Riviera week, and you know the 10th hole, just you know it's a divisive little par four. How do you have guys like Kelly Kraft? How's the strategy different for Patrick Reed compared to Kelly Kraft, or is it the same?
I think it depends on the hole location, for one. I think it seems to me, and honestly, I've never been to Riviera. I've just obviously watched it on TV, and it seems to be, you know, based on the flag, whether or not you go for it or not. But then again, it also is catered to a player's style. I mean, it'd be hard to take the driver out of a certain player's hand if that's their best club in their bag and to have an aggressive nature. But if also if you've got a player such as Zach Johnson or somebody who's incredible with their wedges, and that's the strength of the game. It's like when he won the Masters, he laid up on all 16 par fives for the week and won. And I'm sure there were numerous times when he could have beached the green, but he knew that was strength. It's something that a prime example of a couple weeks ago, caddying for John, he had 242 yards to the 15th hole. At Phoenix, the par five, the island green, which sounds like an absolute no-brainer to go for, because it's a pretty big green. You've got bunkers around there, and as good as he hits it, he's going to hit it on land, you know, 9 out of 10 times. But honestly, he didn't have a club for it. He carries his full iron about 208, 210, and if he misses a groove low, it's going to be in the water short. But he carries his 5-wood about 240, and the greens were firm, and so if he hits that, it probably goes long, which is going to be almost an impossible pitch. And so we didn't have a club for it, and talked him into laying up, because now he has a good enough wedge game. Before, he wouldn't have had a good enough wedge game to feel confident enough that he could get it up and down. And so we laid up with a pitching wedge, and then he hit a same wedge to 6 or 7 feet, made the putt for birdie, and made birdie the kind of a different way that he would have ever done it before. So, again, it's playing to your strengths. I think you got to, again, you evaluate each player and what's good for them. I mean, and then also looking at the whole location. Where is your miss? Where gives you the best chance to get up and down? Is this a better wedge flag, or is this a green light flag? That if we can miss anywhere up around the green, we can still get it up and down, then obviously you go. Overall, by nature, I would say I'm very aggressive as a coach, and that's the way I was in college. I wanted to let my players play. I wanted to let them sometimes. Sometimes you have to make mistakes. Sometimes you have to make you have to even fail to learn. But you better go down swinging. I mean, these scores are getting lower and lower, and they can build these courses as big and as long as they want to. But it's not changing the scores at all. So you better be pretty aggressive in nature and trying to make birdies if you're going to win out there. But still, it's an overall philosophy. It may sound contradictory, but it's not. I mean, it's still very very boring golf. And look at the way Kelly played last week. He shot 15 under, only made five bogeys all week, which is pretty good in some of those conditions. It's just a very boring, simplistic way of trying to map out the golf course and trying to make golf as stress-free as it possibly can. And that goes back to your practice. That goes back to your practice and being prepared in all areas of your game, so there really is a weakness.
So something you alluded to with John and the gap with, like, you know, 4-iron to 5-wood, I feel like with the, 14-club limit, you're going to have either, it seems to be you either have less wedges and more long clubs and you don't have that gap in the long clubs, or you have more wedges and you deal with the gap like John has. Like, I'm a perfect example. I have a 3-iron and then a 3-wood, and I just have this gap there. How do you kind of coach that? What's your overall philosophy?
Again, it's individualized. Mm-hmm. I love the 4-wedge system because I think you're gonna hit way more shots in a round of golf from 100, let's say from around the greens to 50 to 130 yards than you're gonna hit from 210 to 240 yards. From 210 to 240 yards, you may only hit 3 to 4 shots in a round of golf that are hit from that distance. So I think you can get away with having a little bit of a gap there because it's not needed as much. Mm-hmm. But you might hit 10 to 12 shots, if not more, from chipping, pitching bunker to that 50 to 120 yards kind of distance wedges in a round of golf. So the stats say, you should have as many clubs from that yardage as possible, as opposed to having so many clubs at the top end of your bag that are from 200 to 240. Now, again, that's all structured upon a player. You got a guy that doesn't hit it really far, that's not going to have as many wedges, then he might need a couple of extra clubs at the top. Obviously, having for example, in John's gap, having a gap from 210 to 240 is a little bit too much. I wish we could find a way to probably straighten, either maybe put in a 3-iron or strengthen his 4-iron a little bit, but he loves the 4-iron so much that it's a great club for him, and he's very good with it. He needs it on there's a lot of 210, 215-yard par 3s on tour. So it's a club that he really needs. But that gap is not great, but at the same time, I would rather have the clubs at the bottom of the bag so we really, really can dial in our lifts.
So
let's face it, from 200 to 210 yards, if you make par on the hole, you've done a great job.
Yep.
But from 120 yards, you better be averaging under par.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I there are so many. That's one of my complaints with modern golf courses. It's just too many 100 or 210, 220 yard par threes.
And I think that's the point of really getting guys to understand their stats. And that's when I sit down with them. That's one of my responsibilities is keeping up with their stats and keeping up with what's going well, what's not going well, so we can change the practice plan, so we can change how we're doing things, how we're working on things. So it's constantly evolving on what's going well, what's not going well, and understanding, getting them to understand that, again, 30-35 feet from 200 yards is okay. Mm-hmm. 25 feet from 120 yards is not okay. But it's been a really neat experience just to see. I love numbers. I'm a stats guy. I love numbers, and I think it's a large part of our game. I wish I would have done more of this when I tried to play. And if I could have, I wish somebody when I was 20, 22, 23 years of age would have grabbed me by the collar and showed me how to practice in a more effective way or in a better way than how I went about it.
Uh-huh. So somebody, without all the stats like of a PGA Tour pro, like how do you approach it with like your web.com guys that don't have as detailed and, advanced statistics?
Yeah, that's no fun for me as a coach because the PGA Tour does a really nice job of keeping stats and makes my job a lot easier. But with the guys that I work with on the web.com tour. I mean, a lot of it is asking them to keep them on their own. You know, the ones that I think are important, the ones that really help me structure their practice and knowing what we really need to work on, and knowing if we need to spend more time in technique or more time in field-based practice, or whatever it may be. So asking them to do it on their own, and also just constant communication. I mean, I'm a coach that I speak to my guys regularly, whether it's my text, whether it's my phone. My phone never stops ringing, never stops texting, which is, I guess, a good to bad thing. I'm kind of addicted to my job and addicted to trying to help guys get better. But I think the communication, just having them, honestly communicate what's really going on in their game, because stats don't lie, numbers don't lie. You can't hide behind them. Whether it's been meeting with John or Kelly and show them, hey, you're not ranked in the top 150 in any short game category. Well, before this year, what do you do? We got to work with this. But it's cool to see the results pay off. It's cool to see John Peterson this year ranked fourth in total. Granted, it's only been seven. It's only played in seven events, but he's fourth in total scrambling on tour, which shows that work is paying off. Kelly, the last few weeks, has been above 75% in scrambling in each of his weeks that he's had success. So it shows that it's paying off. But yeah, I sure wish the web.com tour would find a way to keep better stats. But I understand with the manpower and the lack of volunteers, it's hard to do. But just getting my guys to give me the information that I need from them, and I don't expect them. Honestly, I don't expect them to come up with the plans. Again, their job is to swing the club, provide me with the information, and then it's my job to set up everything else so they can just show up and play golf.
So, of all the guys, whether they're on PGA Tour or web.com tour, or if they're in college, like, what's the one guy that you would most want to work with that you're not currently working with?
that's a tough question. I might get in trouble for answering that one. I mean, that's a tough one. I mean, who wouldn't want to work with Tiger and try to take on that? I mean, but unfortunately, I think his health is his biggest detriment right now. I mean, we played with Bo Hostler last week in a practice round, and Kelly played with him in the two rounds, and that kid's really impressive and has an absolute ton of upside, and be pretty cool to I don't know who his coach is or not, but whoever it is obviously doing an incredible job, because he's pretty impressive. So I don't have anybody out there that I'm confident enough that I feel like I can help guys get better, but I'm so happy with the guys that I work with and love to work with them. And as I've told everybody, I'm not looking for players. I look to make the ones I have better. If helping the guys I have success and helping them get better leads to more guys, and then I'll be thankful for the opportunity. But to name one guy, gosh, I don't know. It's pretty cool. I'm so thankful and lucky that I get to be around the best players in the world. I mean, playing practice round with Jordan Spieth last week was pretty awesome. And to pick his brain, see him. I mean, the experiences I have with Patrick Reed and seeing one of the best players in the world do his thing. And I know he learned from me, but I learned just as much. Should learn just as much from him. But being around Bubba Watson last year, Simon, watching him hit shots and do things that I never thought were imaginable with a golf ball. I mean, the amount of curve he can put on a golf ball is pretty cool. He would be a fun one to be around just because of his ability, how he hits shots, how he thinks, would be pretty cool. But now just to be around those guys is awesome. I still get amazed every time I walk up and down the range, how lucky I am to get to do what I get to do, whether it's sitting and watching Zach Johnson at Wedges, whether it's watching Adam Scott swing the golf club, whether it's watching, Patrick Reed hit the golf ball, whether it's watching Jordan Spieth putt. I mean, those are pretty cool experiences. Those guys, I would never thought in my wildest dreams I would never thought I'd ever win two national championships, and I darn sure never thought I would be sitting on the range with the best players in the world and being able to help some of them try to win PGA Tour events. And I'm thankful to get to do it every day, and hopefully it's going to keep helping my guys get better, and hopefully they can win a few events and have awesome careers and see what happens.
Yeah. So you coached Bryson in college, and
yeah.
I'm fascinated by DeChambeau. I think his sponsors don't do him well because, anything he's trying, they kind of turn into a product. But like in general, you know, always trying to get better. And I'm fascinated to hear a little bit about what it was like to coach a guy like that.
Yeah, one of the coolest experiences of my life. It was very challenging. It was tough to coach because it was so kind of different and polar opposite than anybody else I've ever been around, and polar opposite of my personality. But I think it was a good fit. He gave me a really neat compliment when he signed and chose to come to SMU, and he had some great opportunities. Looked at Stanford, looked at UCLA, looked at Oregon, looked at a few other places, programs that were much better than us when I first took over the job. And I'll never forget, I asked him, I said, why did you choose us? Why did you choose SMU? Why did you want me to be your coach? And he gave a great response. He just said, you were the only coach that would let me be me, which was a pretty cool compliment. He knew I wasn't going to try to change him. He knew I was going to try to make him better, and I was going to challenge him to get better and to see things sometimes in a different light. But I wasn't going to try to change the person he is. I mean, he's a scientist. He's a physicist. He's the ultimate mechanic on the golf course. He's a robot. He's trying to find perfection at all times. But that doesn't mean that he still doesn't have feel and doesn't have knowledge of how to play the game. And I think that's where, you know, the combination of his ability to swing the golf club and understanding what he does and his belief. What I learned from him the most is what he believes in his way probably more than anybody I've ever seen, and doesn't necessarily think it's right or wrong for anybody else, but knows it's right for him. I think our combination of me challenging him to try different shots, to learn how to practice it in a different way, to do some other things, really, really worked well. And he's going to figure it out. I know he's going through a little bit of a rough time right now, but what 23-year-old doesn't have some struggles on the PGA Tour? I mean, this is all new. This is all new to him. It's new cities, it's new golf courses, it's new. It's a tough deal. It's not as easy as people think. And the kid's terribly talented, and he will figure it out because there's nobody that's going to outwork him. And I think hopefully over time he'll continue to evolve and listen to some of those that are, you know, guys out on tour that have some experiences that he doesn't have, and combine his knowledge of the game with some other knowledges of kind of how to play the game and get a better understanding of things that have worked for some guys that have had a ton of success. And I think he will do that over time. And when he does, he can be an incredible player. But I love the fact that he's not afraid to try things, not afraid to try to, you know, the fact that he's putting, you know, face on, the fact that he's got all the clubs the same length. I mean, whether it's right or wrong, I mean, you got to give the kid credit for trying it. And he'll, at some point, as he's always told me, when there was a couple times when we talked about going to shorter wedges, because, you know, it seems odd that you're hitting wedges with the length of a 7-iron. You would think you would be better with shorter wedges, and he would talk about it, and he would always kind of come back to me and say, Coach, I'm going to figure it out, and he did figure it out, and he's developed into having a very nice short game with something that looks very, very unorthodox. So he's a special kid, and hopefully he'll keep getting better. He's going to keep maturing, going to keep growing up, keep understanding what it takes for him to be great, and he'll figure it out over time.
So
he's going to be just fine. You don't get to a point where you're win the NCAA championship, win the U.S. Amateur, you know, tie for the lead in the Masters. He's got a ton of belief and a ton of game, and it's just going to takes a lot of reps out there and a lot of getting comfortable. It's hard out there.
Yeah, I think he. I think he'll play actually well this week. I think he is built for courses that require a little bit more thought, more strategy, than, you know, the bomb and gouge stuff.
Right.
So what's the craziest theory that he ever came to you with? Were there any, you know, like you hear about Bones having a veto for Phil when Phil has, you know, some crazy idea of a shot he's going to pull off. Did you know? Were there any ideas that you had to just hard veto?
I don't think I ever gave him a hard veto, because I knew I would lose his respect as his coach if I ever didn't let him try it and kind of figure it out on his own. He did have some weird theories. I mean, obviously the face on putting he's talked about for a long time. He's always said that he was going to putt that way. I kind of looked at him like he was crazy, but at the same time, I know him well enough that if it will either one work or if it doesn't work, he'll be smart enough to figure out that it doesn't work, and he'll go back to putty conventional. But there were a few stories. I mean, he would the very first time we were at a tournament, he wanted me to stop. He asked me to stop at the store, and he needed to get some Epsom salt. And I said, what are you talking about? I don't even know what Epsom salt is. He wanted to test all of his golf balls to make, I think it's to find where the center point of the golf ball is and to make sure they're properly centered or something. I can't even explain it properly, but he would know how to explain it much better than I do. But he dips them in the water every night before he plays to try to find out which golf balls are the right ones to use. So, but you know what? That's what he believes in.
Yeah,
and it's pretty cool. But he's a different cat, but he's a great kid at heart, and I hope he continues to get better and better.
You know,
but I think he's got it. It's refreshing to see in this game, because you know, a lot of the game is everybody kind of does things the same way, and he's not afraid to be different, and I think probably. Over time, you combine that ability of not being afraid to be different, but combining that with the ability to learn from others and to learn that there are other guys that can really help him evolve as a player. Combining his knowledge with their knowledge, and he can be pretty special.
Yeah, I think he's going to be a really good pro for a really long time.
So
much talent. So I talk with. You know, my buddies on the Mid-Am circuit, which I like to call the loser tour. And and we talk about, guys that made it and, why we're sitting playing at some local muni on a weekend. And one thing we always come back to is, this irrational confidence that all these guys have. Do you think that is, part of it, this just unbelievable self-belief?
I think it's the confidence in their ability, and one of the neatest things that I've seen, even walking around with Jordan Spieth last week in the practice round. I mean, his self talk is so impressive. I mean, you probably hear him. He's a little emotional. He talks to himself and he talks to Michael Scatty quite a bit on the golf course. But his self talk, he will never ever talk badly about himself. He has the utmost belief. I had a pretty good feeling he was going to have a great week last week because he flat out said, I love these greens. Those greens last week were awesome. They were some of the worst greens I've ever seen. It was wet. They were poana. They were bouncy. They were bumpy. But he loved that because he knows he's a great putter. And he kind of flat out said, hey, if I miss a putt this week, I know it's not me. I know it's just a green. And that sounds arrogant, but it's honestly a factual statement in his mind. It's the way he believes. And so I think that's the thing. You've got to have that positive self-talk and the confidence, and never never beating yourself up, never telling yourself you're not any good at anything. And that's something that I wish I had that. Always the best players I've ever coached, whether it's been Patrick Reed or Hendon Norlander or Don Peterson or Kelly Kraft or guys that just had successful college careers. They all have one thing in common. They believe that they're twice as good as they really are. Unfortunately, I believe that I was half as good as I really was. And that's a bad quality, and that's why I was never as good a player as I could have been, and that's why these guys are really good. And that's not arrogant. I mean, inwardly, you've got to believe you're the best out there. And yeah. You've got to be selfish. And you've got to be selfish with your time, because there's a lot going on out there. And if you're not selfish with your time, it would be easy to get swayed in or pulled in a lot of different directions.
Yeah, my goal this year in tournament play is to never once tell myself I suck. So, I
good luck with that one. I do that about every other hole. Yeah, every hole. That's a tough
one. But
it's the truth. If you tell yourself that, then you're eventually going to believe it, and that's it's a standard line, but it's the truth. You've got to, and that's. One of my biggest jobs as these guys' coaches is there's a lot of the mental side involved with it, and especially if I'm I've ever caddying, but definitely telling these guys constantly how good they are. Yes, you've got to be critical, and you've got to point out what they've got to work on. But one of the things I've always tried to stand by as a coach is when you're coaching, when you're giving a guy constructive criticism, you better point out the positive first. You point out the positive first, then you can point out the negative. If you point out the negative first, they never hear the positive. You could tell a kid, hey, you putted great today, really proud of it. But you know what? We got to work on your chipping a little bit today. Well, they hear that part. They hear the negative. But if you start with the negative first, they never hear the positive.
Yeah.
And I'm a firm believer in that you've got to kind of build a guy up before you can ever kind of bring him down a little bit to make him realize what he's got to do to get better.
So you've touched on Henrik Norlander a couple times, and you know I've heard this legend that he might be like one of the 10 best ball strikers in the world.
I wouldn't argue with that. He's like a second son to me. I coached him obviously in college for 4 years, and still would consider myself one of his coaches, but mainly just one of a really really close friend of his, and we talk. You know, it seems like almost daily we're really close, and he can do things with a golf ball that I've seen very very few do. He's very impressive from tee to green, and now he's starting to really develop around the greens as well. And his putting is getting so much better, and he's got a much better way of practicing. And he's done some great work with Ramon Wisconsin, the perfect putter, and done some really good work, and has a kind of a plan with what he's doing now with his putting. It's getting better. Obviously, that showed with his results this year. Showed with his loss in the playoff at Sea Island, and I expect some really good things from him because he can, from tee to green, he's as good as I've ever seen. One of the few guys in the world that I've ever been able to see hit flighted cuts. And most guys that hit cuts hit them all way up in the air, and he can actually flight it down and control it with the fade. And it's pretty special to watch. And he started to be able to take his game at home and take his game on the range to the actual course, because he's always he's always had a little trouble kind of letting it go and playing without fear. And now that he's starting to understand how to let it go, and that comes with results. When you start having results, it leads to confidence. And then you can work as hard as you want and effectively as you want, but if you never have results, it's hard to have confidence or full confidence. And he started to get that, and hopefully he can get a few more starts in this year and lock up his tour card, which would be quite an accomplishment without having any status this year. But he's starting to believe it. He knows he's always known he can win out there. I've always known he can win out there, but quite honestly, it was almost a little bit of false belief because he really hadn't had any results to back it up. And then now, you know, finishing second at Sea Island ever since then, it's kind of changed his whole mentality and whole belief. And now he has that validation to say, hey, I can get it done on Sunday when it really matters. And I think, you know, once he's in that position again, he's going to close the door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he almost pulled that thing off. That was kind of a crazy tournament out there.
It was a wild finish. I still think if in that playoff, if he could have found a way to hit that six iron on the green instead of in the bunker, there'd been a good chance he might have won that outright. It would definitely put a little bit more pressure on those guys trying to get it up and down, and especially being the last one to hit. But hit a good shot, just came up a yard short, and then hit a good bunker shot, and hit a great bunker shot, just didn't make the putt. But there'll be a lot more chances for him.
Yeah, it was like 30 degrees, so it had to be hard. I mean, for those guys picking a yardage, figuring it out.
Yeah, it was brutal. Yeah, it was a kind of a guess.
Uh-huh. So, you know, with Patrick Reed, he hasn't really been in contention in a major. Do you think it's just, you know, it's only four tournaments a year? You know, is there anything that, you know, he needs to do, to work on to really get, you know, where he's in the thick of it in a major? Because it seems to be that's the last piece of his career. I mean, he's RA and he's young still, but, you know, that's the one glaring missing part of his resume.
Well, if you look at it, he had his best two finishes in a major last year, and he finished 10th at the British Open, and I think 10th. He finished 10th and 11th at the British Open and the PGA, and those were his two best finishes ever in a major. So that was a step in the right direction. But no, that's just honestly, he hasn't played in it. Mm-hmm. That just takes a while getting comfortable, getting in that position. But he will have plenty of major successes. I mean, he lives for that moment. He lives for the Ryder Cup. You can't perform like he has in the Ryder Cup and had the consistency that he had last year and took one five times. That's just the next step. That's just the next step is getting in contention in majors, and he will win his fair share when it's all said and done. But yeah, I know that's a big priority of his, and he will definitely get that done.
When you're doing practice drills and you're competing against them, you know, what's it like competing against Patrick Reed?
You're not going to win very often, so that's one thing. Now he's the ultimate competitor. I mean, he probably hates losing more than he loves winning, and I think that's a trait of a lot of great guys. They hate to lose so badly that they're just going to find a way to win, and that's why he's so good in the Ryder Cup format or in any form of match play format, because he just loves to beat you, and he's just going to find a way to step on you when he's got you, and he's never going to give up. He might have a bad hole here or there, but he's the guy that wants the ball at the end of the game. He's the guy that wants the last shot. He's the guy that wants the football with under 2 minutes with a chance to win the game, and that's why he will have had so much success as a Ryder Cupper, and I think over time he'll go down as one of the greatest Ryder Cup players of all time, because his match play record is phenomenal, whether it's been in junior golf, amateur golf, and college golf. He went 6-0 in match play, and you've seen the success that he's had in the Ryder Cup and President's Cup. And I think it's only going to get better, because he truly just lives for that moment.
Yeah, I mean, he's turned into an American legend because of the Ryder Cup. I mean, like you said, you know, he wanted Rory McIlroy when McIlroy's playing some of the best golf of his career.
Yeah, that was pretty incredible two matches, the Nicholas and Sergio match, and the Rory and Patrick match were about as good as golf can be played on that day. It was pretty awfully special. So he'll be the type that will want to play five matches every Ryder Cup that he participates in. He'll never want to sit out. I can promise you that.
Yeah, it was cool. I think that you definitely. I feel like that Phil Sergio match just got so overshadowed by the Rory Reed match, but you know, like that match was so insanely good. It probably, you know, it seemed like Reed and McIlroy wore each other out by like hole 8, but that match was just 18 holes of unbelievable golf.
Yeah, it was probably the best I've seen, definitely in that format anyway. Uh-huh. Birdie after birdie.
So we'll get you out of here, because I know it's a tournament week. You got tomorrow's the first round, so you probably got your phone's probably ringing off the hook. But last question from Twitter: what could amateurs learn most from, you know, the games of professionals? Like, you know, what can you know, average Joe take away from watching a PGA Tour event, or you know, watching a specific player at an event?
I think the biggest thing they can do is just watch how they manage the golf course, watch how they play the game, and they're never, you know, very rarely do they put themselves in trouble. They know when to take chances with the right clubs. Again, they know with their wedges, they're pretty much firing at every flag. With, you know, 7, 6 iron, 5 iron, they're trying to hit it to 20, 30 feet for the most part, and make their pars and move on. But I think one of the things that I think is really, really special to watch for guys, and what I've really circle my guys over and over and over again, is getting, you know, is around the greens and getting the basic shots up and down. You don't have to get, you know, the best guys, the best short games in the world, they don't always get it up and down. They don't get the hardest ones up and down all the time. But if you watch how they chip and pitch the ball on the basic ones, on the easy ones, they chip at the tap in. They chip, you know, it looks like it's going in all the time. And I think that's something that is very, you know, underrated, is getting the basic ones up and down to where there's no stress. You know, chipping it to where it's tap in, that's how you develop a sound short game. Yes, it's nice to hit the super flop shot, the hard ones, get those close. But honestly, those guys are when they have a super tough shot, they're just trying to hit it to, you know, give themselves a chance to make a putt. But the basic ones, they look at those as scoring opportunities. And you know, quite honestly, amateurs, whether it's juniors, whether it's college players, you know, high handicappers, low handicappers, successful mid-ams, whatever it may be, you can't stress the value of spending enough time around the greens. I mean, if you have an hour to practice, I mean, what does everybody do? They go to the range, they hit as many balls as they can, and they wind up hitting, you know, way too many drivers, and they really don't do anything that really got them better, where they would be much better off spending half their time on the range and half the time chipping, pitching, and putting, and really getting better. And again, I have a simple theory. If you could try to find a way to spend equal time in all four areas of the game, if you're going to practice for 2 hours, if you spend 30 minutes on the range, 30 minutes chipping, pitching, bunkering, 30 minutes putting, and 30 minutes with your distance wedges, and it's pretty hard not to improve. Sounds very simple, very dumbed down, but honestly, that's the first question I ask everybody when I start working them with them. I ask them one question. I say, when's the last time you spent equal time working all phases of the game? And most of the time, nobody's ever been able to answer that with, yeah, I do that all the time, or I've even ever done that. I know I haven't, and I know most of even the best players in the world haven't, but why don't we? If those are the four main areas of the game, why wouldn't we spend equal time in those? And it sounds very dumbed down, but it's the way I wish I would have practiced.
Yeah, it's I think I practice much smarter now than when I was younger, and I always think about, man, if I spend as much time, you know, or at least the percentages I spend now on putting and short game, that when I was a kid, I would have been so much better. So
yeah, and I guarantee you don't spend as much time in technique as well, because you don't have the time. And I think that's the area where I think that we see the biggest fallout is just, you know, we get so obsessed with technique and trying to perfect something that is really, really, you know, it's not attainable, as opposed to the shot making, the randomness of practice, the competitiveness of practice, and really doing things that are going to develop trust, develop confidence that's actually going to transfer to the golf course. Because yes, the technique work is important and you have to do that, but that doesn't guarantee it's going to transfer over to the golf course. Because when you're on the first tee and you're nervous and you've got people around, or maybe it's just playing with your buddies at your home course, you better have something to fall back on and done enough competitive practice and done enough rehearsals that, hey, I feel like I could pull the shot off.
Yeah, I think if that's the smartest way, is just to spend time everywhere and become more well-rounded. But, hey, you know, really appreciate the time, and it was awesome to pick your brain and get to kind of nerd out about golf with you for an hour.
Well, I love it. I'm so blessed with what I get to do, and love making guys better, and it's my passion, and I'm thankful to have a awesome wife and awesome kids that allow me to be on the road a lot of the time, because if I didn't have that, I sure wouldn't be able to do it. So it's cool, and I love helping my guys get better, and hopefully even better things are coming.
Yep. Well, we'll stay in touch, and look forward to meeting you at one of these events sometime.
Sounds great. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.